So, good evening. Maybe we could continue with, if someone has a topic or a theme they'd like to explore, you can even just have a singular word that's of interest to you, as long as it's not the word "the." That one, that could be challenging to work with. It's something that I'd like to speak about, but I'd like to just open the space. If you have a theme, yeah, if you have an area of personal interest or concern, area of personal challenge.
I was thinking during meditation about thoughts, and I was just trying to find where they come from.
Yeah.
And I couldn't.
No, you couldn't find. Right. No one can find where they come from, because they come from nowhere. But it's a good reflection there. It's a good contemplation. Yeah, we can look into that a little bit. See if there's anything else. It can be anything.
I was thinking about the Heart Sutra.
Mm.
And I've had moments of insight lately in which I have had a very real sense of what it means to say the form is emptiness.
Mm.
And I try and then I find my brain trying to find the opposite. Mm. Emptiness is form, and it's not working for me. I mean, no. I know it does. It's jumped in the water on that one before I even started.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, Robin. Yeah. It's wonderful, though. It's a absolutely amazing set of words, you know, that came out of this being. If you don't know the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, this meditator, basically. It was some time after the life course of the historical Buddha and the Dharma, you know, the teachings of the Dharma, the wheel of liberation, in that expression was in the world. It was moving quite a bit. Obviously not all over the world, but in India, and, northern India particularly, Nepal, and it was spreading. And this Avalokiteshvara, in his contemplation, you know, he just realized this truth about form and the nature of form. And then he gave this teaching, you know, that became known as the Heart Sutra, and it's revered in all of the sort of Buddhist lineages and traditions, and it's even revered in other, you know, spiritual traditions as this amazing teaching that just keeps echoing through time. And it's probably recited in monasteries and meditation centers more than any other sutra, you know, singular sutra. So we can look into that a little bit tonight, because that's related to what you said about where the thoughts might be coming from. Anybody else? Can even be a question.
Hi. I'm Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Not you. In Vipassana, are you, in this style of meditation, are you staying just in emptiness? Is that kind of your goal? It's just being present and being in emptiness? I come from a lineage where there's a guided meditation, and we go up the chakras and out the head and back down. And I found that talking to be, like, I want silence. And so I'm exploring other traditions, and I was just curious if you're actually just experiencing whatever you're experiencing.
Mm, mm, mm. So meditation that focuses, like, on energy centers or chakras or the movement of prana yeah, or chi or kundalini, often is something that, you know, historically comes more in the Hindu tradition. However, sometimes people are just doing observation. Like you could think of the word vipassana as just observation. Yeah? Or sometimes people use the word mindfulness. Sometimes people are doing that and spontaneously, you know, things start opening up. You know, like their heart center kind of opens and they just feel this incredible connectedness, you know, heartful, loving connectedness with everything. And of course it comes and it goes. Or they might feel the energy, you know, that deep, dormant energy that everyone has within them. You know, it's basically in the nervous system, arising out of the base of their spine, spontaneously. They're not doing any breath, pranayama, or any kind of particular visualization or anything. These things start happening. Other people start, Ibi sometimes talks with me about a blue light that appears. You know, in certain Hindu traditions, they talk about the blue light. Okay, and it's sort of like this actual image, yeah, of a pearl, yeah, like a blue pearl that will appear in the area of like what some people call like the third eye, yeah, or the brow chakra. And, you know, regardless of what kind of experiences I'm having energetically, emotionally, visually, and to some people they have certain experiences and they categorize those as spiritual experiences, all of those experiences come and go. All of those forms are empty. Empty of what? Empty of permanence. Empty of solidity. Empty of possessibility. So it's very important to recognize, you know, because we have these associations to almost every singular word that we've ever heard. We have an association. We have associations to the word empty. Right? So the bowl is empty, yeah? But the bowl is also full. Yeah? What is the bowl empty of? Other things that you can see. Like right now, the bowl's not empty. It's got a stick in it, striker. What is the bowl full of? Air. Life that you can't actually see with your eyes, like you can the stick. So, with the sort of traditional teachings on Vipassana, there's a systematic opening up to the nature of experience. And for most people, that requires a certain amount of stability. We talked about this last week, and some degree of settledness and concentration, so you actually begin to look into your experience and see it without interfering with it. I was taught Vipassana in a very rigorous, disciplined, and almost militaristic setting. Very, very strict. And I resisted it, but at the same time I saw that it was very, very useful because it really started to work very, very fast for me. What I mean by that is the sense of suffering that I had been so familiar with for so long started to dissipate really fast. And that really got my attention, like big time. It was like, whoa, like I'm really opening up. And then it started to get scary because this emptiness, like things started to just really dissolve and I started to feel untethered in a way that was very scary. So then things started to sort of contract. And I'm taking sort of a number of different experiences and compressing them really short lines about it. But the nature of awakening is to see life clearly, to see things clearly. And eventually to see all things clearly, not just some things, but to see all things clearly. And this isn't just the domain of, say, Vipassana meditation or Theravada Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism or Zen, Christianity or Sufism. It's the nature, bless you again, it's the nature of all of us. our original nature, yeah, our Buddha nature, cannot be discovered because it's what we already are. So to say the words original nature means the nature that's original, the nature that's already here. The reason why we can't discover our Buddha nature or our original nature is because our original nature or Buddha nature isn't an experience. It's not a feeling. It's not a thought. It's not a state. It's actually not a distinguishable form. So does that mean our Buddha nature is nothing? What is it? Well, in a way, it's not ours. Just like the space in this room, and even this room is not ours. When we begin to just, even just a little bit, taste the transitory, ephemeral nature of all forms, and we don't contract back and try to sort of, oh, that's too something scary, unknown, unfamiliar, you know, like that. You know, if that stuff's not there, if there's no resistance, or little resistance, and that opening is allowed, okay, we begin to see that in all forms that are changing, that are empty of solidity, permanence, possessibility, and then the most difficult one for our minds to understand, because they really can't understand this, is that there's no you in there. Okay, that's the hardest one, because we're so invested in being this. I'm this. But if you're sitting and meditating, you begin to feel, just like say in your arm or your leg or even in just in your fingers, like all of a sudden it's just sort of, the whole thing lightens up. You know what I mean? It just becomes very subtle. The sensations become very subtle. Or you can't distinguish the edges anymore. Okay, this happens to people all the time. You don't have to be meditating. You can get a massage, or you can lay down for a nap, and parts of the sense of the body form, you know, become more subtle and even dissipate some, and you can't find your leg, for example. And people are like, no big deal, you know, it's not like it's numb, but it's just like there's a that sense of familiarity with it being a certain way is no longer there for a little bit. Actually getting a taste of emptiness. You see? So our true nature, our Buddha nature, is empty of what? Anything you can name. It's empty of all that. But at the same time, it's empty of all that. Anything you can name. It's full of everything. You know, this is why the Tibetans said, the original nature, the Buddha nature, is too profound to realize. What does that mean? It's too profound for our mind, our conceptual mind, to get it. So to say that it's empty of everything you can name, but full of everything at the same time, that sounds contradictory, or at least paradoxical, doesn't it? And it is, but only to our minds, only to our thinking mind. What we're actually always already sitting in, moving in, breathing in, thinking in, feeling in, notice the word in, is this original nature. It can't be discovered because it's already here. You can't find it because you already are it. Now, to just say that doesn't mean we suddenly go, oh, I got it. Right? I got it. You can't get it. All the strategies that we've ever employed, could ever employ, to get anything, to understand anything, to figure out anything, to do anything, to meditate our way towards, all of those things are completely ineffectual. Now this is really, really disconcerting news to that part of my mind that thinks I'm going to meditate my way into liberation, freedom, original nature. And most people, when they're meditating, if they're feeling, oh, this is like me, I'm sitting there and I'm hearing the teachings, and they're going in and these big changes are happening at the emotional level, psychological level, and then every now and then there'd be this like real stillness that would emerge and just amazing happiness and a love that was not pointing towards anything, you know what I mean? It wasn't even like directed anywhere, it was just boom. And it was kind of an insight that would just stop me in the midst of this meditation that I thought was progressing towards something. You ever notice that sense in your life of progressing towards things? I'm doing this for that. Or waiting for something to change, waiting for something to come. Could be as simple as, you know, someone's going to call you. Someone was supposed to call yesterday at 3 o'clock, okay? So I was on time. Actually, sorry, I was 2 minutes late. Okay, but he hadn't called. So I'm there on time, ready to go. And then it's 10 past. And then it's 15 past. And it's 20 past. So I just, okay, I'm not really waiting, because you know what that's like, right? To be waiting. Not waiting, just doing other things. I look at the clock, oh yeah, 20 past. I'm going to pop him an email. I'm going to be here for 10 more minutes if you're going to call me. Shoot the email, phone rings. Okay, we've all had this experience before. The sense that you are in time, or at least related to time, moving towards things, moving away from things, very common perception, right? Very common feeling. Original nature, Buddha nature, is completely not bound in time. What does that mean? It means that in the moments when, even if thoughts are still there, thoughts are time bound. Thoughts are time, in fact. But even with thoughts still there, there can be a sense of something that isn't changing. And this is what happens as the original Buddha nature, you might say, comes up from the back. That's not really how it happens, but let's just put it like that for the moment. It just kind of appears out of nowhere. Is that there's a sense that there's something going on here that doesn't change. And it's completely impossible to name it, really, or locate it. And one of the ways that that also manifests is that I mentioned it last week as this transrational insight into the fact that all is well, even as shit keeps happening. What I mean by that is just so-called difficulties. Okay? There's a sense, even though you can't find the I, there's a sense that you are completely, radically, fundamentally, transrationally okay. And that's the same, you could say, space. That's the same space as that which doesn't change. As that which is not bound by anything. And yet somehow always here. Even when it's forgotten. When it's remembered, and it's not like I'm remembering, it's just the remembrance comes, there's a sense this has never gone away. I, whatever I think I am, forgot about it. And now it's being remembered. That's why the Buddha said, it doesn't matter how long you forget, only how soon you remember. It's a little riddle. And even for our intellectual mind, which can't grasp this. What's that pointing at? So, the, you might say, process of insight which is often what the classic teachings on Vipassana point at, are kind of like this progression that the mind engages in. At the same time, something of the timeless is showing itself through these insights, like into impermanence, these insights into how no forms last. Everybody got that one? No forms last. You know, these sofas are going to fall apart. I mean, not while you're sitting on them, probably. But, you know, the cloth is dissolving slowly but surely. And if you just wear it a few more days and wash it in the washer, you know, and if you look at my dungaree shirt, my favorite dungaree shirt, yes, it's all faded on the back, you know, and it's, if I wore it here, you'd probably say, get rid of it, man, it's done. It's over, man, it's not even Goodwill material. It's finished. So we get the sense of the dissolution of form, but yet, oh, this is lasting. No, it's not. And that's not a morbid, pessimistic, or negative thing. It's the truth. So we get a sense of both a truth that's changing, the cloth, you know, the weather, the feelings, the thoughts, the sensations, and seeing that clearly is part of Vipassana practice, is to see the nature of form clearly. Still don't necessarily know what it means when Avalokiteshvara said form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is none other than emptiness, emptiness is no other than form. And he goes on for a few more paragraphs to basically say the same thing with a few more additional words. So the, you might say, observation or insights into the nature of form allow the life experience to become more fluid, more harmonious. As long as you have a basic fundamental ethic about caring for others and oneself, and that your actions, your outer actions, do not disrupt this. If you disrupt this, you know, if you're engaged in things like, they just caught some guy recently, they got him extradited out of Thailand, okay, he's a major, major, major arms dealer, he's a Russian dude. Major arms dealer, right? And he was just cropping up all over the place, and he had all kinds of ways of moving around, and he's selling arms to the Taliban, he's selling arms to the Congo and Sierra Leone, and they finally, you know, they did a sting on him, and they caught him in Thailand, and they held him in Thailand, and Thailand had a problem letting him go, and finally they let him go, and now he's in the United States. And they got a big charge in him that he's selling arms to people who verbally say, you know, we want to take out America. So, okay, that's enough. You know, we got a case. He's going to have a hard time meditating. He's going to have a hard time seeing the kind of things we're talking about, because if he actually goes into his experience and he's not denying what's happening, it's going to be really conflicted. Because the motivations that have been driving those actions are really out of harmony. With what? Care, generosity, kindness, love. You can't do that kind of stuff and be loving other people. You can hardly be loving your mother when you're doing that stuff. And you should love your mother. I mean, even if she blew it. A lot. It wasn't her fault. It was her mother's fault. They were doing the best they could and you were in the way. That's what my mother said to me once. She smashed my toy on Christmas morning. She smashed it big time, the elephant. Yeah, and then I asked her years later, what was that about? And she said, you were in the way. Okay, really? Of what? You? Where you were trying to move? Yeah, it's like it had meaning that we could get into later about what that really was about. So, you know, obviously the things that happen to you that you don't see coming, you get blindsided by, those things have to be dealt with, and therapy is a good way, but also meditation can really help you deal with the things that happen to this body-mind process, that happen to your sense of self, yeah, which is often your personality. You see, those have to be resolved, because they create impressions, they create contractions in this, inhibitions in this, confusions, emotional complexes, that has to be dealt with one way or the other. I'm not going to really be able to see original nature and rest into the nature of what you are if you're distracted over and over by things that you're fundamentally not. And what are you fundamentally not? You're fundamentally not anything that's unsatisfactory. And guess what? Anything that's unsatisfactory is actually all form. You know why it's unsatisfactory? Because it doesn't last. The only thing that's truly satisfactory is what you actually already are. Now, notice where that's going. That's going to a place, at least with the words, that's completely non-locatable. No one in this room, certainly not me, can point and go, that's what you actually are. Right? There. It's impossible. I said last week, it cannot be defined, but at the same time, it cannot be confined. It's everywhere and nowhere simultaneously. It's infused through all form, but not limited by any form at the same time. It manifests, and I'm talking now about original nature, it manifests in time, but is unlimited by time simultaneously. Now you can see why the Tibetans say it's too profound to understand. It's too close to see. And of course, then one of the biggies for many of us in this culture is we feel undeserving. You know that feeling? Feeling of undeservedness or unworthiness? All you have to do is notice somebody in the world that you know, your personal world, let's say, who you think has it better than you. That perception right there is the perception, to some extent, of a degree of unworthiness in yourself. Somebody has it better than me. You know that comparison? Somebody's got a better house, they live in Tioga, or Hale, they don't live in the Southeast. Okay, they have more than a cinder block house. Their dog is healthy. Their mother was kind. They have money. They have a healthy body. They smile more than I do. They have better karma. That's undeservedness in my mind, comparison. So how then is original nature or Buddha nature realized? Once you begin to see that you can't realize it in the way that you think, the answer to the math problem, make a decision, act on it, create a certain result through your actions, that doesn't work. Oh, wow, does that mean I just like, who cares, heedless, let's go party. Down to the pub we go. That would be the other extreme. I can't do it, so I just quit. Screw it. Oh, the middle way. Very clear in the description through the teachings. The middle way. What is the middle way? Path between the extremes. What is that? Form is empty. Can we appreciate that right now? How all form is empty. Empty of solidity. Empty of possessibility. Nothing here can be possessed. You could say, this is my belt. You can't keep it. Put your name on it. And we're taught to do this sometimes with objects when we're little. Put your name on your coat before you hang it up. And put your name on your book. Even when you put your name in your book, you don't keep it for life, do you, in most cases? And if you do, it's a false perception to think it's actually yours. Because there's no ownership. Emptiness is form. And your insight or awareness can help us with this. Where do those thoughts come from? Because call a thought a form, right? A thought is a form. It appears, disappears. Where does it come from? It comes from emptiness. So again, here's the mind thinking, oh, form is emptiness, emptiness and form. We try to get that in a linear sense. Form is becoming emptiness, emptiness is becoming form, and then around it goes, oh yeah, yeah, I got it. No, you don't. You just think you got it. Same thing as the original nature, Buddha nature. It's got you. It's what's already happening. This is the Heart Sutra. This is form is emptiness, emptiness is form. This is everything. Everything is the Heart Sutra. Really? Okay, try this. Is there anything outside the truth that form is emptiness? Feel that for a sec. Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm having difficulty with the concept of form because
yeah.
I've only recently started exploring, you know, Eastern thought.
Yeah.
But I've spent a long time studying Western philosophy, and, mm-hmm. and for me, form is tied very, very strongly to Plato and his idea of form, capital F form, but which he meant. A good example is the chairness of a chair, independent from any specific chair, just the idea, the you know, not the material, but it's a very non-material word for me, form. It's you know, this is a very particular pillow, but the form pillow isn't a very, an extremely abstract thing to me, and I guess I'm asking how you're using the word form.
Right. It was hard for me to follow you. But that's okay, because it might be hard for you to follow me.
Well, instead of trying to explain what I mean by, or what Plato meant by form, maybe I'm just asking what you mean by form.
Yeah. What I mean by form is all things, including the pillow and its unique pillowness. Now, what I'm also suggesting here is that all form, all things, objects, another word that's useful for form, all objects, right, are interdependent with all other objects. Now, I wasn't around when Plato was here, nor Socrates, nor Plotinus, who I think actually, if you study those characters, I think Plotinus was opening to something a little bit more sublime than those other guys, although those other guys were into something pretty interesting and having an influence on their culture and their time, as well as philosophy in the Western sense.
So thingness.
Thingness.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Does that help?
That helps a lot, because Plato essentially meant the opposite. The not thingness,
yeah,
was what he meant. So, again.
Yeah. Now he...
Can I jump in a second?
Sure, go.
I think when Plato talks about ideal forms, this is just a thought. It's pure thought, in fact. But it's just a thought.
Yeah.
Buddhist terms.
Right.
And it arises and disappears.
Okay. Yeah.
But when you say form, you mean object, like a
yeah, I mean object.
Thing, a physical thing.
I do. Not necessarily a physical thing. Mental thing, thought. Emotional thing, all things.
Okay.
Yeah, all things.
That has thingness to it.
Thingness.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a physics teacher once told me there's only two categories in the universe. There's stuff and oomph.
It sounds like form and emptiness.
By oomph, he meant energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And by stuff, he meant matter. But that's sure. Physics. I mean, and he was trying to break it down. Stuff
sure.
And oomph.
Sure, sure.
So is energy considered form?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. Sure. Anything relative. Yeah. Everything relative is another way to talk about form. Yeah. All things. What was that word again? Oomph.
Oomph. And stuff and oomph are interconnected.
Yeah, but
the
equals empty square.
Yeah. Sure, sure. So what's fascinating is it's lovely to play with the language and attempt to know what we're talking about. Okay, but the actual insights into the nature of form, now here's another set of words, the nature of form, the insights into the nature of form reveal that all form is empty. And the word empty right here refers to the fact that it doesn't last. That it's impermanent. Okay? Now, the other thing that physics has helped us realize, not too long ago, is that all these forms that are ever changing, particle, wave, whatever you call these things, are interconnected. This is really huge for us in terms of the liberation of our lives. And that is this. Everything is interconnected with everything else. So my perception of myself as a separate form, you're over there and I'm over here, that's an illusion. It's an illusion based on the conditioned nature of my thinking about myself, which has probably been passed from other beings like Mama, Papa, and other type characters. Maybe not that science teacher, because that was pretty juicy. I wish I was there for that. Give me some of that second thing you were talking about. I like that. But if the physics teacher was on it, they would have said, see all that stuff, the CA, the BA, da 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 da, and so on? That's the nature of relativity. That's forms, and those things don't last. And this that you're sitting in, that you call yourself, doesn't last. Now, some of the kids would have gone, oh, I don't know about that one. I don't like that. You know, I kind of like being here. Are you talking about death? Yeah. We're talking about that the truth, scientific, metaphysical, rational truth, experiential truth, is that form, all forms, all things, are empty. And that emptiness, yeah, that spaciousness is another word you could use for emptying, that spaciousness is form. All forms are spacious by nature. You go, okay, that's cool with the planets, yeah, everything's cool, spacious. What about when I'm contracted into my, I'm having a hard time? That doesn't feel like spaciousness. That doesn't feel like emptiness is form. This form feels like, ugh. And thus, the most difficult thing to abstract. Notice this language is potentially abstracting, right? The most difficult thing to abstract is suffering. Because I believe and think I am the one. Unhappy, sad, disappointed, suffering. And if I don't just, I don't care, which some people do, when it's hard enough, bad enough, thick enough, unpleasant enough, they just, I don't care. What can arise out of that are two things, and this is fundamental. Two things arise out of that difficulty. One, bewilderment. I don't understand. And the other thing that arises is searching. Or you call it seeking. Wanting something different. And that's what propels the spiritual search. That's what propels the so-called journey or path. We begin to see, though, that it isn't just the thoughts that arise out of nothing or space. Feelings arise out of space or nothing. This arises every morning into the waking state out of nothing. The nothingness of sleep, it arises. There it is again. the story of me, the story of what's important. Oh, I got to call Ann, I forgot about that, and I got to do that, and that guy's supposed to call me at 3. Mind starts, there's the story. And if you're not careful, you think that's your world. And for many people, that is their world. That's the world that I live in, and that's real. Actually, what that is a waking dream. It's a waking dream, and what I mean by that is very simply this. The waking dream refers to the fact that all those forms are empty of solidity, empty of possessibility, empty of an essential you. Okay, there's no you in there that you can go, there's the me in there. Okay, is that clear? Because you can't find the you that's in there. Where is the you? But it's an appearance, it's a dream, simply in the sense that it doesn't last. And most human beings, without even any meditative experience or deep insights from other activities, can have a sense, and it can be very sublime and subtle, that there's something here that is interrelated with everything, but at the same time, in a certain sense, untouchable. That it's transrationally okay. Children have this, and they don't talk about it with one another. Babies have it. They don't talk about it with one another. They don't have language for it because they're just vibing it. They're in it. They are it. And when the vulnerability of this form falling away, eventually just stopping being, I like to call it stopping animation. This is animation, right? So it's going to stop being animated. Is that's coming, and there isn't a resistance to that. If you study that experience among humans, you see the same sublime transrational realization that everything's fine. Everything's okay. That I, not in the sense of a localized I, am okay, am well, is the truth. So Joseph Campbell put it very well before he left us. During his life, towards the end of his life. You know Joseph Campbell, the mythologist?
The power of myth,
yeah. Wonderful, wonderful man, wonderful life, wonderful expression. He used the word the real. Begin to get in touch with what is real. Begin to see what is real. And he's pointing to that which doesn't change. And your life begins to organize itself around that. Because our life is organized around things. Have you noticed this? It can be organized around certain things at certain times, and then those things can change. Could be your job, could be your role, could be figuring something out, sorting something out. And what your life is organized around can change. Topics of interest, areas of interest, people in your life that you're with, activities. But when he said you start to become clear about what is real, and what he's talking about now is what doesn't change. Dreams are essentially not real because they don't last. The real is what lasts. The real is what doesn't change. Original nature, Buddha nature, doesn't change. And all beings, not just humans, have this nature. Rocks have it. Isn't that amazing? You say, but Paul, everything about the rock is impermanent. Everything about the cloud is impermanent. How can these things have this nature, this original nature? You can see how your senses, nothing about your mind or your senses can get a hold of this because it's incomprehensible, impossible to conceptualize. Something that is everywhere and yet nowhere simultaneously. Mind can't get it. But if there's a sense of simply curiosity arising in relation to where these words are pointing, then that's the, you might say, movement of awakening. That's the movement of the realized nature that's already here, beginning, you could say, to realize itself. And there's many byproducts. One of the byproducts is harmonization, greater balance, ease, diminishment of fear, diminishment of confusion, diminishment of greed. If you actually look across the face of this earth and you see the things that people are troubled by, the diminishment of all of those things. Because all of those things that trouble human beings, aside from the natural disasters which come, the things that we do to ourselves and we do to one another, these actions are born from confusion. They're born from misunderstanding. They're born from greed. Why does the arms dealer keep trying to make the deals and then finally he gets caught? They'll probably lock him away for life. Or maybe, I don't know what they'll do. Because he's driven by something. In the moments where you stop being driven by anything, what's life like? And I don't mean you're just like, I don't care. You just... Because now you're driven by something else. Called what? Heedlessness. I don't care. Now the middle way is profound, deep caring for all things, but non-attachment to those things at the same time. And if I'm invested in having certain kinds of experiences in my meditation, then I will stay in the realm of trying to have certain experiences. But if I'm interested, if I'm curious about what is it that's here that's having these experiences, what is it that's here that doesn't change, then the whole meditation or contemplation takes another course, you could say, and that course is a course that actually allows the timeless to appear. There's nothing in the way of timelessness. There's nothing in the way of freedom, except the ideas and the plans and the goals. Even the goals or plans or ideas to try to realize that. Those are the only things that are in the way. There's nothing in the way of freedom, except the idea that it isn't here. There's nothing in the way of the timeless, unbounded nature, the original Buddha nature. There's nothing in the way of that, except the ideas, the actions that come from those ideas, the lifestyle that comes from those actions and ideas that say it's somewhere else. So does that mean then the person just says to themselves, well, it's not somewhere else, it's right here, and that's going to make it happen? No, you can't make it happen because it's already happening. You could say, you know that little trick that people sometimes do it during the holiday, Christmas time, where they all have that gift that has the boxes inside the boxes? The best one of those is when you have boxes inside boxes inside boxes inside boxes, and the last box has nothing in it. That's the teaching. You're looking, and they tricked me, they forgot. No, they didn't. It was intentional. They're jerks. There's nothing there. So in the emptiness, in the realization that all forms are empty, and this is not so much a part of Vipassana, at least it didn't come to me through my exposure with Vipassana. It came through the exposure actually with the teachings of Jesus and Sufism and the Advaita Vedanta, which is the non-dual paths, if you will, of Hinduism, and through Zen, and through poetry, and Rumi and Hafiz, and then through nature itself, the natural world. And that is the sense that the practice is wholesome and healthy, and the sense of being able to have a comfortable, relatively speaking, cognitive, sort of intellectual way to think about yourself or think about your life, or even to think about spirituality or to think about, you know, anything, is a useful thing, because then you can use your brain and you use it well as a tool. But that all of that and your very practice itself is like the empty box at the bottom of all the boxes. And that emptiness, this is the key piece now, that emptiness is full. In the realization that all forms are empty, it's then that the realization of interconnectedness, non-separation, and the fullness, you might call it the love, if you will, the love, that transrational love that manifests right in the midst of that which you could call for the moment the empty box. And you yourself are that empty box. This is why some teachers then say, okay, Paul, be really careful here, because emptiness is not nothing. It's not nothing. See, we have a connotation about nothing, don't we? Nothing is no thing, right? Nothing. No things. Emptiness is fullness. Emptiness is completeness. The great teacher Nagarjuna said, because of emptiness, everything is possible. Because of emptiness, he's basically saying enlightenment itself is possible. Liberation is possible because of emptiness. But guess what? What he didn't say is that emptiness is form. Avalokita said that. And enlightenment, liberation, is possible because of form. Now let's go even deeper with that. Liberation, happiness, fulfillment is possible because of suffering. Because of suffering. This is the completeness. This is the end of duality. The mind would say, no, liberation is the end of suffering. No, that's not true. Liberation is the end of the idea that you're the one who suffers. And so, that point, it's almost commonsensical, not mystical or extreme and in no way esoteric or metaphysical, to say form is emptiness. It's completely, utterly, totally obvious. So then, like, one of your sort of proclivities is to come back in and think about it. You know? Some of us have that more than others. A lot of us have that tendency, even when these things make complete sense. Our mind comes in and wants to kind of create a story, conceptualize it, even if I just have the interest to explain it. You see, but there's also moments where what I like to call the utterance of truth just comes out of human beings. And there's no premeditation about it. And it's really clear in listening to a being speak from this place that it's authentic, that it's true, and it's absolutely spot on. And it could be about something as simple as how they feel. But it's one of the expressions of freedom, it's one of the expressions of truth. It's one of the best things about group therapy, in my experience, is that when people get connected and trusting enough, they start speaking the truth, and from whatever place it's coming from, it resonates into the field that we share, and everybody is awakened by hearing those things. And the Dharma is just like that. The only thing is that the Dharma, especially when we begin to move to the aspects of the Dharma that are non-dual, they transcend our conceptual mind. They transcend our emotional life. But actually our emotional being, or our sense being, or our bodily sense, can more readily and more easily resonate with non-dual truth. And what's a non-dual truth? Very simply this: form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's a non-dual truth. Your original nature, the original nature, is everywhere and nowhere simultaneously. That's a non-dual truth. Original Buddha nature cannot be confined nor defined. That's a non-dual truth. A dualistic truth is everything changes. Nothing lasts. That's a truth that refers to the field of relativity, to the field of things, to the field of objects, to the field of form, or the realm, if you like that word, of form.
Is that because we have to counterpose the idea that things could last?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
that's what makes it dualistic.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fundamental pivot point is for the dualistic perception is that I am the subject. Yeah? I am the subject, even if it's my sense of myself as a personality. I am the subject, and these other things, like you and the water bottle, are objects. Okay? Now the subject, so-called myself, and the object actually are completely inseparable. But in order to get that, you have to include space, and these the particles that you can't see that are touching in between here. Otherwise, people have to say, well, the only way these two things are inseparable is if I go like that. But still, it's separated because I can feel my hand is, now they're working on maintaining duality, I can feel my hand is separate from the bottle. And there's a bottle in my hand, those are two different things. Okay, these are all thoughts. If the hand simply rests on the floor and the idea of hand and the idea of floor go away, that's non-dual truth manifesting. And when people do this, little exercise, I'm not saying you do it now, but if you do this, say tonight before bed, just rest the hand there and go into the space, maybe close the eyes. Let go of the concept of hand and floor and simply sense what's present. It may be a strong or not so strong dissolution of separation. And there's unity. A moment of unity. What we miss is that those moments of unity are happening seamlessly, continuously. And they're so continuous and so complete that they include all the moments of separation. So every moment that you think of yourself as a separate being, that's liberation appearing as a sense of a separate being. That's freedom appearing as a sense of a separate being. The idea that I am going to release myself from being a separate being and merge with all of creation, that's liberation appearing as the idea of a separate being who's going to dissolve him or herself and merge with all of creation. That's what's called to me the inside out. The opposite of what we think. Okay. Now what? That was a long kind of roundabout piece about Vipassana. It basically means insight. So it isn't about just sitting in emptiness, it's about sitting in what's true, what's real, what's happening, that could ultimately, and will ultimately, appear as emptiness.
What did you mean by liberation is the realization that you are not the one suffering?
Simply that.
Who is suffering?
Simply exactly like you said it.
If you're not suffering, if I'm not suffering, then who is suffering?
No one. There is no suffering when you're not suffering. The sense that I'm not suffering, someone else is suffering, that's me suffering in my sense of someone else. It's a projection. If you contemplate unsatisfactoriness, okay, in any form that you contemplate it, what you see eventually is that that which constitutes the sense of unsatisfactoriness is the sense that this that's unsatisfactory is happening to me. When there is no me there, there is no unsatisfactoriness. That's what it means to say. Liberation is the falling away of the idea that you're the one who's suffering. The mind, when it hears about the end of suffering, thinks that that's the end of unpleasant feeling, that's the end of things that I love going away. Things that I love going away is liberation appearing as things that I love going away. So the whole sense of being someone to whom suffering is happening, okay, this is what becomes the, you might say, fundamental contemplation or meditation. And as that unfolds or opens, that conditioning, that's what it is, I am suffering, that's a conditioning, as that unfolds, as I said before, that transrational insight, all is well, all is always well, that is timelessly, seamlessly, continuously true, even as the wars continue, and even as there's not enough food for everybody, and even as America's making more pollution than every other country, although the Chinese are catching up, I heard. Even as all that's happening, the transcendent, transrational truth, the transpersonal truth, is that all is well. Now, the good news about that, too, is that the more deeply that's realized, if your proclivity is to help, and your so-called idea of yourself and your investment in being a good doobie and all that is gone, then you're liberated more and more to respond to the difficulties, the ups and downs in the relative world, the so-called sufferings of others, much more freely, because you're not in the way. Prior to that, your story, your identification, in my own case, you know, meditating with peace activists years ago, I found them to be the most disturbed people. They were the most angry people. At least that seemed that way to me. They were the ones with the, "Ah, this is wrong, this should be happening. What are we going to do about it? Where's the sticks? I mean, not the sticks. Where's the right words?" So they start. And there would be occasional person coming through, like this guy from Guatemala who got kicked out of Guatemala because he was too radically peaceful for the government. And he was a priest. You know, and we finished meditating, and I just like wanted to go and talk to him. And the next thing you know, it was like 10 people, and he had no agenda. He was just sitting there being happy, peacefully. He was a real exception to the people. We gotta do something. That's how they looked. After we meditated, like, we stayed up late doing this stuff. It was like one of those retreats where you didn't have a timetable. So it was like 2 in the morning, we're having these discussions about peace and war and what to do about it. And then those of us who couldn't take it anymore, like me, time for bed. You get up the next morning and there's the mind of like, I'm going to resolve the wars. You know, resolve the war, and the war is, I believe that I am suffering, and I believe that my war will end when I am not suffering. That's completely confused. The truth is, you don't exist as you think you do. What's sitting here is a composition, a lovely, unfolding, spontaneous composition that's being written and directed by nobody. Okay? Nobody directed this show. And it's unfolding spontaneously and seeing that formation that's empty, that you call yourself, clearly, is what liberates the idea that you're the one suffering. The idea goes, and then as a byproduct, and there's still unpleasantness and unsatisfactoriness, but no one's there invested in it one way or the other.
Trying to avoid it.
Yeah.
Trying to cling to.
Yeah. Give me this, keep that away. That's what goes away. Goes away for a second, there's a second of liberation. Goes away for a minute, there's a minute of liberation. Goes away for good, that's emancipation.
It's just experiencing things as they are.
Correctly. But no one's experiencing things as they are. They're just happening.
Because it's the ego or the I, it's the I sense that wants to control what's happening.
Absolutely. It's the whole complication. And so that's the fundamental inquiry or meditation in Vipassana. So did this that I now said confuse the teaching about no one suffering, or did it clarify?
No, thank you. I'm a little confused, but it's not about, I got a lot out of what you said, and my mind created some confusion.
Do you want to flesh it out? Because you can if you want. Try to clear it up?
No, it's okay. I don't want to take all the time. I just let this dissolve, and I let this kind of settle, and then I'll have it.
Okay, that sounds faithful. So yeah, if it doesn't dissolve on its own, and it still hangs around, then it can be addressed. This is, you know, the other thing about meditating and inquiring authentically is that things dissolve effortlessly, which is kind of what you were talking about there a little bit. Like, it just, I'm going to let it be, and it's going to take care of itself, kind of thing. And if it does, that's fine. It's wonderful. And sometimes, if you're the kind of person that likes to ask questions, as you get into the meditation and the inquiry, what happens is the questions, they either get answered spontaneously by just sitting with them, or they dissolve before an answer comes, and that's the answer. The answer, let's say it like this, the answer to the question, who are you, is the dissolution of the question. The form goes, falls away. Anything else?
Good.
Yeah.
I wanted to thank you for answering my question in advance, but I might as well ask it now since you've already answered it. And it was a question that I could never ask, because I'll explain. You mentioned these blue lights that some people see when they're entering meditation.
Mm.
And I always wanted to ask someone about them.
Yeah.
Because I've experienced that as long as I can remember when I was falling asleep.
Mm.
But having been trained as a rationalist, if I ever asked the question, do you see these blue lights when you're falling asleep, then there was a small chance that my suggestion might have affected the answer I got.
Mm.
But you mentioned that other people see these blue lights.
Yes.
Mm. So I just wanted to thank you deeply for answering my unasked question.
You're a delightful rationalist.
and verify this phenomenon that I could never really verify with someone else. And once I started learning about different mythologies, I don't know if anyone else is familiar with Neil Gaiman and the Sandman comic series, but I thought about, I designed a name for that, because it was about 20 minutes. It usually takes me about 20 minutes to fall asleep. And Neil Gaiman describes the dream world. I mean, his whole comic series takes place in the dream world. And so in my beginning of my spiritual quest, I started thinking about that as entering the dreaming.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, mine's not really centered. It's kind of off to the left.
Into the left. Really
means yeah. On, but it's kind of off here this way.
Yeah. Maybe you're a lefty.
I'm
a lefty. Mine's to the right, though.
But anyway, it's deeply fascinating, and I want to thank you for verifying that that's not just some optical illusion.
Right. It's a product of concentration. In one sense, okay. In one sense, it's a form. That's empty. Any image that appears, yeah? Geometric pattern, color, shape, okay, these are just manifestations of form, and they're empty. Okay? Now, if your mind is attached to experiences, which most people's minds are somewhat attached to experiences, and that's part of the reason why we suffer, is because we're attached to experience. Because we're attached to experience, we then have a tendency to cling to experience. If you cling to something that by nature doesn't last, I mean, just think about that for a second. Automatically, there's some degree of, obviously, friction, or you could say, suffering that arises there. Okay, now, the original nature, the Buddha nature, or the true nature of mind, right, is completely, utterly, totally, boundlessly open. There's no clinging in it, there's no grasping in it, there's no attachment in it, no identification in it. Okay, it's the only way you can really point at this stuff is to use like an image of the boundless night sky that holds everything. Okay, that's the nature of mind.
It always seemed to be sort of a passageway.
Hmm?
It seemed to be more than just a light to me, but a passageway. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, everything is a passageway. Not just those lights. Everything that's happening here is a portal. What is all of this a portal to?
Well, I named it The Dreaming because of the mythology that I read about from Neil Gaiman.
Right, right. And that was your reference at that time. What I'm saying is everything, lights and all of this, all things, yeah, are a portal into vastness or emptiness. Okay, all birth canals, like once upon a time it occurred to me that we're in a birth canal. You know what this birth canal is? This birth canal right now is called the human realm. We're in a birth canal. You think, oh, the birth canal is when you came through your mom when you came out. Yeah, it's a birth canal. This birth canal, yeah, is the birth canal of conditioning. The opportunity in the birth canal of conditioning is to see the nature of conditioning clearly. As you see the nature of conditioning clearly, form is emptiness. As you see the nature of conditioning clearly, you begin to see naturally beyond the conditions. And that seeing beyond conditions is a kind of sublime happiness or joy. It's not based on sense pleasure, which is fine. Oranges, I love oranges. Sense pleasure, yeah, comes and goes. You start to taste the insight, yeah, experience the insight of that which is beyond conditions. So everything is a portal. So everything is not just a thing. And maybe Socrates, Plato was saying this, I don't know. I studied them some, maybe not as much as you. Maybe they were saying this, I'm not sure, but the language wasn't clear enough for me to get it.
I'm not that great a teacher. I'm still a student.
Yeah. You share very, very honestly. You share very openly in your experience.
I think Plato was looking for the changeless also. He was trying to find, identify something that doesn't remain permanent. Because he was fully aware of it. ephemeral nature of all things too, of course. As any thinking person, who must be. But you know, he went into the cerebral realm and tried to came up with this theory,
figure it out.
This idealization theory.
Right.
That just is the only thing that he can identify as changes.
Right. It's very difficult to use the thought, to actually use the thought to transcend the thought. There's only one being that I know of that's currently in you know, the world with us. It's this French man. And he actually, very interesting life experience, but he actually used Descartes' formula, I think, therefore I am, to realize the changeless. And he's, from what I can see, he's completely resting and unconditioned. Now, as a funny kind of side story, is he's a chain smoker. And if you want to hang out with him, you have to be able to tolerate him puffing continually. You know, you know, unabashedly puffing. He's a French man. He's a French guy.
I'm asking French, and I'm just curious because a lot of what is written in that language makes more sense to me sometimes than what came from English.
Yeah.
If you don't, I'm just curious.
His name?
Yeah, what his name was.
His name.
I'm trying to remember his last name. His first name is Stephen. He wrote a book called Cutting Through the Conditioned Mind. You can look him up on the internet.
Okay.
But I'll have I'll remember his name in a minute. His last name went into the unconditioned for me. It dissolved.
Just Google the French man.
The French man who smokes and is enlightened. see if Google can find it. It'll come back. It might come back before we part. It's just a blank right now.
That's fine.
Yeah.
This is interesting. You've already given me enough to work on for photo one.
I'm good. It's working on you. Okay, that's the thing. As contrasted to working on something, that's the progressive mind trying to understand working on something. When we settle back in meditation, we're not working on anything. Life as the portal, experience things as the portal, are revealing themselves. So in a way, in that sense, you're not meditating. We think we're meditating, that's just an idea. Meditation is life presenting itself in this unbelievably wonderful myriad of forms, basically saying, in so many words or nonverbal expression, wake up. Wake up. Wake up to what's here. And because that is so sublime and so continuous and so simple, we overlook it. We overlook it and we're looking for something special, something different, something extraordinary, something that's like what the books say. Maybe it's in the blue light and the blue pearl, and maybe... And it is in those things, but it's not just in those things. Why? Because that, what I'm pointing at, is in everything. It's impossible to avoid it, although you can think you're avoiding it. It's impossible to acquire it, because how can you acquire something that you already are? You can't acquire something that you already are. You can't attain something that's already happening. So then what is this about? This is about the falling away of misunderstandings that cloud the clear realization of what you truly are. I'm sorry, you had something?
It's kind of amusing to watch the mind work sometimes. Even the most sublime experience can become so quickly attached to the most sublime experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what else to do with it, honestly, besides get attached to it and allow it to sort of speak to me about who I am, yeah. You know, and all that. Today I was in the Har Museum and I was looking at some Chinese vases. And they didn't have any images on them whatsoever. They were just little patterns. But for some, this scene just flashed into my mind You know how often in Chinese art you see these gnarled old trees and rocks and up in the mountains and all that, you know? Well, this scene just flashed into my mind of, and I found myself in the scene, standing on a high mountain, very cool, and this is not me, you know, I'm all about the tropics. Very cool, misty, gnarled roots, rocks, the heavy scent of pine, you know, in the air. And it just struck me, you know, this is somehow emblematic of the eternal. And, you know, it probably lasted a nanosecond. And then, of course, since then, I've immediately attached myself to that moment and used it to try to augment my personality or something.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right. Why not?
Yeah.
Right. But see, your personality, all of these personalities, yeah, are continually being augmented by that which is emblematically eternal. That's, to me, what Christ meant when he said, I want you to have the abundant life, I want you to have it now. That's what he was saying to me when he said, look at the rose. He wasn't saying, analyze it, take it apart. He was saying, you are the rose. It was straight metaphor. So that subtle thing, and then you fell into the sort of non-typical for you, you know, image and sense and feeling, and then there's a nanosecond of like, aha! You know, and then I try to turn that into something. Even my attempt to turn that into something, you know, you might call it a watered-down version of the eternal, but it's not really that. There's something happening here that is both in time and beyond time simultaneously. And we can't get it with our mind, but we can open into a sense of that, as you call it, the nanosecond. And that's the nature of realization, is that it's not bound by time, it's not about progression, and yet it's manifesting through all the things that are unfolding apparently progressively. And the word apparently progressively is very important. And what I mean by that is simply that they appear. The word apparently refers to the appearances. The dream nature of this waking state. The dream nature of the dream state. The dream nature of everything that comes and goes. Okay, there's something here, and some people call it the one dreaming. It's not really even that. There's something here that sees these things. I call it the witnessing. Yeah, I call it awareness.
I got to explain meditation to sixth graders from a Christian school today while he was in this sublime moment. I had my own little sublime moment.
How'd it go?
Oh, it was fun.
How'd they take to it?
They just looked at me.
She did a great job. She said something about watching. They asked you what meditation was or something, and she said that part of it is watching your thoughts. And they said, well, how do you watch your thoughts? And she,
I told them, I said, you daydream, don't you? And I said, it's like you let yourself daydream, and then you just step back and you think about what you're daydreaming. Mm. You know, what was I daydreaming about? Mm. And
worked for them?
Yeah.
It worked for them, yeah.
Do you get a chance to go back and do session number two, or is it a one-shot deal?
No, they're gone forever. It was a sublime moment.
Impermanence. Yeah, carpe diem, you know, seize the moment. Yeah. That's right.
College students are much harder.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Most of the time. Yeah. Sixth graders are open.
Sixth graders are less conditioned in the conceptual ideas of life and themselves, but the patterning has already begun because they've had at least a few years.
Yeah, because one of them, well, she was talking about Buddhism, and she said, you know, do you know who Buddha was? And this one little guy piped up right away, a false prophet. But then Dina said he noticed he kind of contracted after that, like maybe he shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
I would have wanted to go. who was the real prophet?
Oh, he would have had already.
Yeah, and then I would have, and then I would have said, why?
But you don't go there. You don't have enough time for that.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. See, because Jesus...
I had 30 minutes with them.
Right. What's tough there is that Jesus is the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And the Buddha is Jesus, just like form is emptiness, emptiness is form. The Buddha isn't... This Buddha, yeah, isn't the historical Buddha. It's not a person. It's not a human being. Mm-hmm. It's the manifestation of unconditional love. Mm-hmm. That's what it really is. But, you know, you didn't have time for that.
And I don't think his teachers would have approved.
No. Well, he could have gotten you into some tricky spaces. You would have had to stir him up and then say, okay, now close your eyes and observe your thoughts. Yeah, beliefs are powerful and beliefs are very, very, like, cherished. Of course, the deepest belief is that I have the truth, you know, this is the truth. You know, I exist as this, and these are the truths, and, you know, this is the way things are. The good news about the Dharma and the exploration or meditation that helps in the realization of the Dharma is that you can go straight on past and not have to bother with belief systems. You don't have to bother with assumptions. They're really completely unnecessary. And you don't have to prove anything to anybody. You don't have to hold to a position, you know. Like, even though there are some Buddhist traditions, they like to do debating with one another. It's really just for fun, you know. They're not trying to, like, sort of win, you know, in that sense. There's nothing to prove. The truth doesn't need to be proven by any human beings. Okay. Well, thank you for coming tonight. Oh, next week, Ib and Rich need to be away, and I don't know where I'm going to be exactly, but how many of you are interested in meeting next week? Anybody? Or everybody taken? Just Robin? Two? Three? Let's take it off. You'll be out of town. Let's take the week off. Ib, can you send an email out on the listserv? Let everybody know. And then we'll meet in 2 weeks. We'll come back in 2 weeks. Okay? All right, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah.